Blog Talk Radio.
People whose lives have been ripped by the criminal justice system, people who are reentering back into society, they have lives that matter too. We are produced by the awesome Beverly Black, the creator of Tribe Family Channel Gumbo for the Soul, and co-produced by Diane Sears, the U.S. coordinator for the International Men's Day, and author, editor, and host of In Search for Fatherhood. If you're listening or you want to call in later to ask a question or make a comment, please write this number down, 347-539-5285. Again, later on in the show, we will open up the lines and you can call in at 347-539-5285 with any question that you have for me or my panelists. Perhaps you know someone who's not near a phone, but they're near a computer. Call them right now, or get to them right now, and tell them to listen online at www.blogtalkradio.com, Gumbo for the Soul. We're excited to be your host. I am your host, Dr. Maxine Bryant. I am a criminal justice professor at Georgia Southern University, in the beautiful city of Savannah. I've been working in the field of criminal justice, particularly with individuals returning from prison, for the past 30 years on and off. That's my gift. That's my God-given gift, to work with that population. And I am excited. I am thrilled. I am just beyond myself, because I have two of the women in the studio with me who have a passion similar to mine to help people who are incarcerated to successfully reintegrate back into society. We have Dr. Gaitonde from California, and we have Miss Felisa Dennis from Philadelphia. Welcome, ladies. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We're going to have fun hour and a half conversation, and we're just going to talk. I have several questions I'm going to ask you, and we're just going to converse about the things that matter as it relates to people returning from prison and people who are still incarcerated. Now, what I want to do, the audience who generally tunes in on the fourth Saturday of every month knows about me. They've heard my voice before. But I'd like to give you an opportunity to tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself and what your role is as it relates to working with incarcerated people or previously incarcerated individuals. So can you take about 3 minutes to speak to our audience about your role with incarcerated persons? Doctor, we'll start with you.
Okay, I am so happy to be with your listening audience, and it's an honor to be on your show. I am Dr. Rajshree Gaitonde, and I have the distinct honor of being the first female physician to work at the notorious maximum security Folsom Prison. I specialize in internal medicine, infectious disease, public health, administrative medicine. I have a master's in health services and in public health, and I've also gone to law school, and I specialize in medical legal law. I have a passion for taking care of my inmate patients, and I think I would have a lot of interesting information to share with you as the program goes on. I'm looking forward to talking to you more. Thank you.
Awesome. I am sure you're going to have a lot of interesting information. One of the things I thought about as I read your bio is that for a little while I had a contract with an African-American infectious disease organization that specialized particularly in HIV testing in our prison. So I definitely want to talk to you about that. Felisa Dennis, on the other side of the country, Philadelphia, introduce yourself to our listening audience.
Hi, hello, everyone. Thank you again, ladies, for the invitation. My name, again, is Felisa Dennis. I have an organization here in Philadelphia called the New Phase, Inc., and we are a restorative justice organization, and we work with the population of those who are released from prison. They are referred to us, and once they are referred to us, we work with them for 90 days. For 90 days, in those 90 days, we don't just hand them papers and send them on their way, but we actually build a rapport with those who were recently incarcerated. We connect them to the resources that is needed to reintegrate back into society, and that falls under education services, housing services, mental health services, and many other services that is needed, again, to be a law-abiding citizen again, and that is who we are. We started back in 2016 but got incorporated just last year, and we are a continuous growing organization.
Awesome.
I hold my a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. I was a corrections officer in the Philadelphia prison system also. Currently, I now work where I place youth from the criminal justice system in homes or are either taking them out of homes due to whatever reason they may have been.
Awesome. I am delighted to have both of you for the next now it's less than 90 minutes, but we're going to have fun talking, and we're going to educate our audience and share some information that I think will be beneficial to people who know people who've been incarcerated, as well as those people who've been incarcerated themselves. So I wanted to start this afternoon with an introspective type of question for each of you. Now, each of you won't necessarily answer each question that I have, but I thought this first one would be really good for each of us to really kind of take a look at. When you think of the work that you've done with people who are incarcerated, people who've been incarcerated, what are some of the challenges and rewards that you see, that you experience What are some of the challenges that you experience working with that population? And then what are some of the rewards? Because I believe when we have a passion to do something and we're doing that, we get some type of reward from that also. Felicia, you want to start with that question?
Yes, I would love to. Some of the challenges, I guess, for me and with the New Faith Incorporation, when they're released, they have to want to begin to change. They have to want to do something different. They have to want to start a new beginning and on a positive path. The challenging thing for me is I want that for them when sometimes they don't want it themselves.
Okay.
So it's like, okay, I know you can do it. I see it in you. You have the potential. Let me help you. Then there's some that's like, I'm not ready to be helped. Am I not ready? I don't want your help. I'm okay. Thing is, you can't fix something if they don't see the problem themselves.
You are so right.
Absolutely. So that's the challenges. The rewarding thing for me is after, again, within those 90 days, for example, I have a client that I was recently working with that he came home, wanted to change, enrolled in a parenting program. He is now working, staying out of trouble. And we always do check-ins with him even after they're released from our program. We always do check-ins, but to see that he is still on a straight and narrow. To see that, to get the thank you, to get the, if it wasn't for you. And so, those are the rewards for us at the New Faith, Inc.
I would have to concur with that. Definitely on the reward side. I live in Savannah, Georgia now, but I did a lot of work in the Indianapolis, Indiana area. And I still have people I worked with in Indiana who will reach out to me either through social media or by email or by phone to let me know the impact that my intervention had in their lives and in their success. So definitely that is a reward. I can second that, definitely. Okay, Dr. Gatonde, can you answer the same question? What are some challenges and rewards that you've experienced?
Oh, my God, this is a pretty deep question, and I really need to share a little bit of my background for you people to understand why I was so passionate about correctional healthcare service. When I was a little girl, I was blessed to be born into a very privileged family. My father was the head of the airline industry in charge of all of South India, and my mother was a brilliant psychologist, and she taught me everything that I know, all the morals, and she instilled in me a deep faith in the divine, and I always knew, even at the time, that I was always protected and guided. There's a little incident that took place in my life when I was a little girl, maybe 4 years old, and I need to share this with you and the listening audience. The Inspector General of Prisons lived opposite our home, and he had a beautiful, lush garden. And one weekend when everybody was out on vacation, I, as a little girl, 4 years old, was playing in the garden. My parents were not home, and I was standing near the gate and observing the people working in the garden of this particular gentleman. I saw a group of people all dressed up in some kind of a uniform, which I could not recognize as a child. But one thing I remember is that they were all tied together with some kind of a rope or a chain, and I don't remember that. But I know that they were tied together, one behind the other, and they were sitting in the garden and gardening. It was a hot, sunny day. As I looked at them, in my heart, I could not understand why these people were tied together. I was a little child, and my mother had always told me that we are all born free, and freedom is our greatest passion. So I asked my maid, I said, well, who are these people? And she told me, you should not even go there. And I said, no, I'm going there. I want you to make a fresh yogurt drink. I'm going there. I'm going to give them something to drink because they are thirsty. So I was very bold. Even as a little kid, I just crossed the road and went into their home. The policeman who was guarding their house recognized me. He knew that I lived opposite. So I told him that we got some drink for these people and I'm going to give it to them. So he said, go ahead. And I told my inmates to give it to them. And when I went and I was watching them and talking and looking at them, they really didn't say anything to me, but the look on their face, it was enough. The gratitude. They were so happy that their thirst was quenched. And I felt something deep within me, even as a child, when I observed these people, and I said to myself, I'm going to grow up and help these unfortunate souls, and the rest is history.
All right. That is absolutely awesome. And I had a similar kind of epiphany, Doctor, but I was a lot older. I was in high school, and I had wanted to be a heart surgeon. Never mind I didn't like science or math. I was going to be a heart surgeon. And I was in a typing class, and we had to do a report on a profession that we were not interested in. And I thought, well, who would want to be interested in working in a prison? So I'm going to write a report on that because I'm definitely not interested in working with those people. And, you know, that report changed my life because I did the research. I found out the status and the state of U.S. prisons. That was in 1976, perhaps. And so it was before mass incarceration, but we definitely had an incarceration. We were headed in that direction. And it changed my life. That doing that paper created within me a passion and a desire to help people to reintegrate back into society. So, that doctor, you explained your kind of the reward you get because you are able to help people, and that is your passion. But in your work, certainly you've identified some challenges.
Of course, I had a lot of challenges.
Can you share one of them with us?
Yeah, you know, in fact, when I was the first female to work in Folsom Prison. I mean, they did not have a lady doctor. And so you have to know that I was creating a new path. And that was not walked. I was walking alone, creating a path, and I think I did it with divine guidance and help. Mm-hmm. But my chief had told me something that really resonated with me the very first day that he saw me. He said to me, Rajshree, your problem will not be the inmates. You have a nice presentation. You can speak well. You dress attractively. You are kind and compassionate. But your challenge is going to be some of the staff. Actually, we had a small minority of the staff who, now I'm talking 30 years ago, really felt that a lady had no place in prison, that I did not belong there. Mm-hmm. And they even took bets that I will not last for 24 hours. But I lasted for 24 years with a magnificent career in corrections.
Okay.
And so really speaking, I think that was the biggest challenge for me, is some of the staff who, you know, who kept giving me problems. But my inmates, my patients,
I hear that.
Gave me all the respect and all the rewards.
Yes. And it's such a male-dominated field where, like you said, even now, females in corrections are not always and consistently respected at all. So I can imagine with you being a trailblazer, how difficult and challenging that definitely was. Let me go to Ms. Dennis. Ms. Dennis, you have really an aftercare type of program where you're working with people to help them successfully reintegrate. How are they referred to your initiative?
Well, so currently it is word of mouth. It definitely is. We are also in a few directories. We have relationship with different people from the prison system, and of course the new thing is social media. So you have you can have a family member that know that her brother, sister, or mother, someone will be released from prison in 30 days, and you know they'll reach out to me and my team, hey, Felicia, or hey, you know, the other ladies on the team, hey, you know, I have a cousin coming home. Here's his information. And we give her our card. We give her our phone number and email. We let her know, hey, or him, we let them know when they're released, send them our way. Again, we sit down with them. Once they're released, we sit down with them, get the information that we need, give them the information that they need, and we take it from there. The rest of the 90 days are building a rapport, helping them. And, again, after those 90 days, we don't just say, okay, you're done, you know, go about your way. There's definitely checking in afterwards to making sure that they are on track, because 90 days, is 3 months. That is very, when you're first released, those are the most vulnerable times,
right?
Because you're back out into the same community,
right?
Or you're back out with the same people that you're, you know, hanging with,
right?
And so we try to really catch them when it's that very important time once they're released.
Okay. And so do you do any type of screening or anything?
Absolutely. So,
okay.
especially when it comes to, because this is a lot of it, when they're released, everybody, once they're released, they want a job, right? So we always start with the question, any sexual offenses? Because now that limits to the type of job, you know, that are employment that are open to you. So there's definitely screenings. We also have a relationship with the Public Defenders Association here in Philadelphia. So we give them their name, see any charges that are pending, anything that may come up that may be somewhat of a red flag that we need to pay attention to.
Okay.
We try not to turn anyone away, but if we can't work with them, there are definitely other organizations that we connect them to.
Okay, great. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
From each of your perspectives, what would you say is among the most difficult factors for people reentering into society? And I'm not just talking about getting a job, but what are some of the things that are either innate within them or challenges they face externally? What do you think are the most difficult factors for individuals transitioning from prison to community? Either one of you can answer.
You know, for me, from my perspective, I see that the prison for many of these inmates is a place that they are very comfortable with.
Mm.
They have their friends. They have housing. They have clothing. They have food. They have medical care. It's all there for them. And they don't have a whole lot of skills to survive on the outside. They don't have a whole lot of friends to help them survive on the outside. They don't have a job to help them survive on the outside. If they are really with some illnesses or sicknesses, I honestly don't know what kind of health care they would have on the outside to get the proper kind of treatment. So, yes, they have a lot of challenges when they go on the outside. And I can remember, you know, one Christmas, on one December, I had tried there was an inmate who was going to be paroled, and I did my level best to get him paroled on Christmas Eve so that he would be with his family on Christmas Day. And I thought that he would be very happy, and I really did a lot to make certain he'd get paroled. And when I went back to work on December 27th, and I was making my rounds and crossing the yard, he was joyfully calling out to me, Dr. G, I'm back. And I went to him and I said, my God, what happened to you? Why did you come back? And he said to me, this is home. This is my home. This is all I know.
Wow.
I could not
live
free.
Okay. And we run into people like that who the outside is really frightening. As I said, I teach criminal justice, and I was just teaching today is Saturday, on Thursday, to some people or to my students. And I was telling them, some people, when they have the opportunity to try to go up for parole or get out early, they will choose to max out. They will choose to do all of their time in prison as opposed to getting out early for a number of reasons. One, they don't want to be the hassle of dealing with a parole officer. But a lot of it, I think, speaks to what you were saying, Doctor, that level of comfort. We call it institutionalized, becoming institutionalized and fearing what faces them when they get out. Lisha, now you deal with people who are on the outside, and I particularly want to hear from you and your experience as you help them to successfully reintegrate. And I'm going to talk about that word reintegrate versus reentry in a minute. But what are some of the challenges that, the difficult factors that you witness them facing as they're transitioning?
The mindset first. You know, their mindset. It's the culture shock, because you have those that have been incarcerated. A lot can change in a year. So imagine someone being incarcerated 5, 15, 20 years.
Yes.
So those are factors. So we have their mentality. We have the culture side of things. And their environment, like the doctor said, you know, for some of them, prison is comfortable in a sense. Prison is safety in a sense. Prison is consistent. It's structure in a sense. So what I have seen with those that are coming out is the culture. For me, the biggest thing I've seen is the culture shock. It's coming home and everything is different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I can fit in. I had a client who came home and he did not know anything about touchscreen phones.
Right.
Like something as basic as that.
Right.
You know? So those are some of the things. And we sit down and we talk to them. Okay, you know, when was the last time? Okay, you've been incarcerated for 2 years. A lot has changed. Their mindset, their mentality of things. You know, okay, now that you are home, what's the next plan? Where do you see yourself? And we do short term goals and we do, you know, long term goals. Where do you see yourself in the next 3 months?
Okay.
Then it's the next 6 months. So yeah, for sure. Those are the factors that I see.
For my dissertation, I studied a cohort of individuals who had recently transitioned from prison to community, and there were two people's stories that resonated for me while I was interviewing them. One of them told the story of how once he got out and he would go on job interviews or whatever, he would shuffle his feet and people would look at him really, really weird. I heard you, Felicia, so you know why he shuffled his feet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why? Let's tell our audience. Felicia?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking on mute. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Now, was he shuffling his feet because of the shackles that he's used to being on his ankles?
Mm-hmm. That is part of it. And the other part is that, and this is something I hadn't thought of, in prison, you don't want to come up behind someone without them knowing that you're coming up behind them. So even if you're walking in a free area and you're not shackled, you want to make some noise to let the person in front of you know that you are approaching. And so he had gotten in the habit, because of the shackles and because of the need to notify others that he was approaching, to make noise. So he shuffled. Mm-hmm. And that was a hard habit for him to break, because he realized, I don't have to shuffle anymore. But he did it, he said, for about the first 3 to 4 months he was shuffling. And to be shuffling in public, right, people looked at him like he was real weird, and he said, What got his attention was that he was at a job interview, and he realized as he was going into the office to meet the interviewer, he was shuffling. And the interviewer looked at his feet, and he's like, okay, I don't have, you know, that was like an aha moment for him. The other story that resonated with me is a young man who told me, he had been out years by the time I interviewed him, but he said that he was so used to having to use the restroom in a public area without any privacy, not being able to have a door closed behind him, that when he came home, he was home by himself for he had been home a day or two, and he went to the restroom and he left the door open out of habit. And he said, you know, I looked at the door and I realized I'm out of prison. I can close the door now, right? So little things like that, the mindset of what you all are talking about, the touchscreen phones, or even during the time when I first started doing this work, ATMs had just come out. And can you imagine going in to prison and all you had, you didn't even have drive-through banks. And now you got ATMs, right? And we had to teach people how to use debit cards and the ATM cards and all of that. The other thing, and let me ask you about this, what you think. I think that not only is the challenge that's facing themselves and their own ways of thinking, but the fact that society continues to hold them in chains. Society continues to hold them in bondage because of our fears and what we hear in media and what our politicians are telling us. What do you think about that? The fact that society continues to put shackles around them, so to speak.
Yeah, this is Felicia. Absolutely. Absolutely. And like, it is society. You have family members. You know,
yeah.
You have, and you know, people of business. I mean, they do, and it's sad.
It's so sad.
It really is. But yes, they still hold them to their path, to those bad choices that they made. Absolutely, I agree 100%.
You know, they can't get food stamps if it's a drug-related felony. You can't apply for financial aid if you want to go to school if you have a drug-related felony. In most states, you cannot vote, so you're not a full citizen. You know, the list goes on and on and on with those collateral consequences that society holds on them. And so, speaking about society, let's talk about the current administration and Jeff Sessions and his desire to go full force with the war on drugs. What impact do you think that that's going to have, particularly on people either who are in prison right now or who are being released during this frame of time with Jeff Sessions' kind of get tough on crime mentality?
I want to, Dr. Maxine Bryant, I want to just add a comment regarding the fact that the society puts shackles around the inmates, you know, for these people who come out. I think I have, and in fact, I think that I wanted to do something to awaken society that it is not, that the inmates are not all what they are portrayed to be. And that is the reason why I wrote my book. The book, 8,596 Miles, which is now available on Amazon. I want people to read it because it will tell you my experience, which is such a positive experience. Because inmates are just like human beings.
Yes.
You treat them positively, you know. And I'm thinking to myself that, you know, I have had so much of people telling me, my God, we did not even know what it was to look behind the walls. And here you have the courage to put that down in writing, what it is to be there, what it is to interact with them. And so I think to all your audiences, I would strongly advise, this is something that I have done. It's a kind of legacy, but it's also something to let people know really what happens behind those tall walls. What is physician's experience?
Absolutely, and we can get your book, 8,596 Miles, My Leap of Faith, My Journey, on Amazon.com, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
and, you know,
great.
I'm getting all kinds of stuff about the book because it's becoming a hot seller because people are finally getting some idea of what it is, one person's perspective of being behind the walls and taking care of these patients.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing. Now, as it relates to Jeff Sessions, but before we go to Jeff Sessions and that kind of conversation, I think it's time to hear a word from one of our sponsors. We're going to have a commercial break.
Okay.
the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. Tune in, www.blogtalkradio.com, Gumbo for the Soul, to listen to the lively conversations that are relevant, dynamic, and inspiring on the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. The first segment, Groove Talk, is dedicated to uplifting listeners and engaging them in life-changing conversations that can help move them forward with their weekly tasks. The second segment, When Is My Debt Paid?, focuses on challenges and successes of released prisoners as they reintegrate into society. The Dr. Maxine Bryant Show.
All right. Okay, so Jeff Sessions, who wants to start that segment off?
I'm sorry. What was your question? I'm sorry.
Okay, so here's my question: what do you think the impact of that we're going to feel, particularly those of us who work with people who are being released from prison? What do you think the impact of Jeff Sessions' desire to move forward with the war on drugs and this get tough on crime kind of mentality? What's going to be the impact for the people we work with?
Jeff Sessions. I mean, I hope it's, every time I hear the term get tough on crime, I like, mm-hmm. I cringe in a sense because we want the problem to be fixed, but not get tough. And I get the toughness part because I know, you know, we can't be lenient in a lot of areas, but I cringe every time. I mean, I would hope it gets the job done. I would hope it's not more of racial profiling. It's not more of targeting a certain race or a gender. If we're trying to, crack down on drugs, let it be that. So the impact, I hope it's an effective impact. I hope it works. I hope It doesn't create more of an issue, more of a problem.
And see, here's my fear, Felicia. When the war on drugs started, when Nixon first introduced that concept, and actually crime was not on the rise during that time, but they needed to focus on something, needed to fix something. And then Reagan made the phrase really, really popular. And they tended to go after African-American men, let's say black and brown men, because Hispanics were in that group too. And they were the targeted ones. And lightweight drugs were targeted, and people were getting long sentences for marijuana use, for example. And even now, and so here's where I'm going with that. The war on drugs, the get tough on crime, did not impact crime. It did impact our incarceration rate. So now that we incarcerate more people in the United States than any other industrialized country in the world, right? So it didn't fix the problem. If it didn't fix it then, I'm wondering why we think that it's going to fix it now. So that's one of my things. The other thing is that since it has never worked, and now we're having an administration that wants to crack down. For example, I'm going to use marijuana just as a example. We have states across our country that have legalized marijuana use. We have Jeff Sessions, Attorney General of the United States, who wants to override that and make marijuana a class of a drug that carries with it, that continues to carry with it, long sentences. So now we're going to have, again, this is my fear, people in our prisons for nonviolent offenses where we could better use community corrections and or treatment, doctor, to address these things as opposed to incarceration. So my fear is that the impact will be a resurge of incarceration, and we were on a downward slope coming out of the Obama administration with prison reform. Downward slope meaning we were recognizing that we cannot incarcerate ourselves into a safer community per U.S.
Absolutely.
Attorney General Holder, and we were beginning to recognize that there are other alternative things we can do. We can engage in better treatment on the outside.
Absolutely.
We can engage in
Absolutely.
A continuum of care so that when they transition from prison to community, as doctor, and you know this, that continuum of care can continue to follow them for physical health and mental health. And we can have programs such as the New Phase, Inc. in Philadelphia that we can fund them instead of having organizations like yours, Felicia, to have to fend for themselves and use our money wiser. My fear is that with Jeff Sessions and his mentality, his policies that he wants to implement, it's going to roll us back a thousand, you know, I'm not going to say a thousand years, but definitely a couple of decades.
As far as I'm concerned, drugs, you know, we have a problem in the California prison system, which is overcrowding.
Yes,
and these crimes, the drug crimes, are generally a nonviolent crime, you know.
Right.
And so I honestly believe that these people should be treated outside in treatment areas, and we do have them. We do have these treatment areas, and the prison should be basically for real violent offenders.
Okay,
and
right.
That's the way
I agree, Doctor. I'm sorry, Doctor. I was just saying that I agree.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, I honestly believe that drugs is a crime, which there are so many reasons for that. And those reasons should be addressed first before you just take somebody and put them in prison. I don't think that that's a quick fix.
Absolutely.
Because that's
not
really addressing the real problem.
Right. And when
Absolutely.
You talk about the home, the families that are broken, the income that is lost, the interruption of life in terms of citizenship, we're not doing anybody any favors. We're not fixing anything by incarcerating low-level offenders, misdemeanors, and minor crimes and nonviolent offenders. We're not helping.
No, we're not. You know, I just posted on my social media yesterday. I said we can't arrest our way out of every situation.
We can't. Right.
We cannot. That's why there, you know, like Doctor said, that's why there are clinics and different organizations
Absolutely.
Similar to the New Phase Inc. You know, we can't. But I also feel like again, it's a population of the browns and the blacks that are being targeted and being. So I mean, look at the cash bail that keeps poor people locked up. You know what I'm saying? So it's a population that's being targeted.
Right. And another thing I want to just kind of throw out here to you ladies is the whole notion of so many of our policies as it relates to incarceration are designed and determined by legislation as opposed to by the courts. And this is where I'm going with this. There was a time when judges had discretion and they could decide, okay, based upon the circumstances, this person, I'm going to use this example. There's a woman in Georgia several years ago who stole like $300 worth of baby formula. I don't know why she stole the baby formula. I don't know if she really had a need for baby formula or if she was going to sell it. But at any rate, it was her third crime. She had a misdemeanor and a felony and a third crime. That was I can't remember how they classified that, but because of three strikes, you're out, she was sentenced to like 20 years for baby formula, okay? And that was because it was mandated by the three strikes, you're out law. That law is legislative. The judge didn't have a choice. There's a man in Florida named, his name just left me, but he shot a warning shot, not Marissa Alexander, this guy's case happened before Marissa, but he shot a warning shot at his daughter's boyfriend who was beating up on his daughter. He was 53. He's going to be 73 when he gets out. This is a college-educated man who was working at Disney World, right? No one was hurt. If he had killed the boy and it used stand-your-ground law, he wouldn't be in prison right now. But Right. You know, our legislators have taken so much discretion away from our courts. What are your thoughts about that? Those policies like three strikes, mandatory minimums, determinate sentencing. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, the three strikes thing. You know that you gave an example about the lady that I guess that stole the
baby
formula.
Really?
And if that was her third strike and she was stolen, I just believe that's absurd. Do she have a child? And I'm not excusing.
Oh, and she did.
Steal.
She did have a baby. I just don't know if she was stealing to get money
stealing
or stealing because she needed the baby formula.
Right. So, I mean, whether for whatever reason, whether, you know, whatever her reasoning was for her to be thrown in jail of a simple, you know, it's absurd to me. Again, it goes back to who's being targeted and why in these policies. And this is why it's important for us to vote, not just for presidential, but this is exactly what I talk about a lot when it comes to just voting for who sits in the office, who's in these courtrooms, who are we, you know, who's dictating all this. The three strikes you're out, and for her to, and even the man who did not kill anyone, no one was harmed, but he was being a parent, he's seen his daughter being, you know, abused in a sense, and he shot a fire off, so... Yeah, it's absurd to me, and again, this all falls under criminal justice reform. These are the things that we have to get in order. We have to somehow fix and improve.
Absolutely. So, and you mentioned something. I mentioned it too when we talk about black and brown people. From your experience, I'll start with you, Dr. Gatonda. What was the racial makeup of people who were incarcerated at the Folsom State Prison?
As far as I am concerned, now you have to know that I have been retired from Folsom for almost 10 years.
Okay.
And I worked there about 30 years back. And so when I was there, I would really have to, in my mind, because I'm seeing all these patients, I think one-third white, one-third black, one-third Hispanic. I would think that was the ratio.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I had all patients. I had all of them. And I really am not an attorney to know all these different statistics, but as a physician, because my job was there only to take care of the patients. You know, I wasn't making any different rules, regulations, or legislation. But the rules I would have made is according to my patient's care, you know, what needs to be done and stuff like that. So I would have to say that we had a mix of all three races.
Okay. And not more of one group than another group. Pretty much a mix around white, Hispanic, and black.
A mix around when I was there. But now if you ask what it is, I wouldn't know because I haven't gone back.
All right. I'm just asking your experience, from when you were there.
Yeah, my experience was a probable equal mix of all three.
Okay. Felicia, what do you see in terms of people coming to your program?
I see majority. I have a population of Latino and African American.
Okay. And that seems to be historically the population that finds themselves behind bars more. Historically, more white people are on probation. They get probation in their sentence, and we get imprisoned, we meaning African Americans and other people of color. So I was just wondering what your experience was. Dr. Gatonda, let me ask you this. One of your specialties is infectious diseases. When you were working at Folsom, was there a prevalence of HIV and other infectious diseases?
I would have to say no. I'm very, very surprised because that I saw a little more is I think that we had some cases where the skin reaction where they would have converted into a positive PPD, but they did not have active lesions in the chest. And I was very familiar with tuberculosis because trained in India and went to different parts of the world to get special training in the treatment of tuberculosis. And I was surprised that we had very few cases. And as far as HIV goes, as soon as you found a case of HIV, you would have to send the patient to Vacaville which was a facility which had a big medical facility, and they are the ones who took care of the treatment care of the AIDS patients. They were not housed in Folsom. They had to be immediately transferred there.
Okay.
I did not see a whole, in my time, I had very few cases of HIV.
Okay, great. So how was testing done then? Did they involve in pre-test or testing for pre-release to know a person's status prior to release?
As far as I can remember, they did the testing as soon as the patient came into Folsom, even if they came from a different facility. They all were tested at that time.
Okay.
As far as the tuberculosis goes, that's what I'm saying. The TB goes, I know that was the thing. As far as the HIV goes, there was no mandatory HIV testing, no. The patients had to request that. And they had to be willing to have that test done.
Okay.
I don't know if that has changed. Maybe it has changed now because it's been almost 10, 11 years since I've left and lots of things have changed. So today what is happening, I really don't know. But when I was there for HIV, because I had just one patient, I remember that correctly and very clearly, and we had to have he had to volunteer and tell me that it was okay for us to take the test. I could not force it on anybody.
Okay. What about continuum of care, doctor? What do you know what happened to individuals after they were released?
I don't really know what happened to the individuals after their release because my concern and my job was taking care of them when they were incarcerated. That was my job. That was my care. But the thing is, I know that there is a pretty good parole program for mental health that I'm aware of. And I also believe that for chronic diseases, there is a parole program. But if you ask me the specifics, I don't know because that was not my field. I was taking care of patients in the prison. That, if you ask me, did we send them to specialists? Yes, we did. Did you send them to outside medical doctors? Yes, we did. That I'm aware of.
Okay.
And I'm knowledgeable about, yes.
Felicia, for people who go through your program, who come to your program, are you noticing that they are connected to health care or mental health care?
Am I noticing that if they need to be connected or they're already connected?
If they're already connected, if they already have some type of referral coming out of prison to take care of their mental and or physical health?
I have not had a client that was already connected. Now, that once we sit down with them, that's one of the questions we definitely do ask. You know, as far as health insurance, that's very important. You know, their mental health. I have not had a client that was already connected, but that's another service that we provide. We connect them to if they need assistance with health insurance, if they need assistance with any type of mental health services.
Okay.
We definitely connect them with those sort of resources.
Great. I do recall when I was a contractor, and one of the things that we stressed was the need for continuum of care, particularly as it related to infectious disease, so that prior to release, there was a referral made to a particular agency, whether it was a government agency, private agency, or whatever, so that that care could continue and there would not be a lapse of medication or time of treatment or what have you. Unfortunately, that did not take off across the country, is my understanding. Let's take a pause here. We're going to hear another word from one of our sponsors. We'll hear a commercial now.
Need a speaker for your next event, conference, or church service? Dr. Maxine Bryan may be available to come to speak from her wealth of experience and knowledge on multiple topics. A licensed minister, Dr. Maxine Bryant draws upon God-given communication talents and gifts and combines proven instructional design techniques and award-winning presentation style to inspire and instruct, educate and enlighten, plan, promote, and problem solve, and embrace participants in an exhilarating experience. Call Pat Monks at 612-876-7964 to find out how and how much more you can get when you arrange for Dr. Bryant to come speak at your next event.
All right. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about people with criminal histories, and I tend to use that term because there are people who experience the ostracizing in society who've not necessarily spent time behind bars, but they caught a felony and perhaps received probation as a result. And so I count them as people with criminal histories. And also, let's talk about this for a moment. I just want to get your thoughts on it. Here's my perspective. Reentry is when people leave prison and they're given a certain amount of money and a bus ticket home. So, for example, I come from Indiana. Indiana will give individuals $75 and a bus ticket home and say, hey, see ya. Best wishes to you, right? Georgia gives them $25 and a bus ticket. That's reentry. Of getting back into society on the individual whom society ostracizes or doesn't even want in their neighborhood, so to speak. In my mind, reintegration speaks to now the community getting involved in the successful reintegration or becoming a part of society of that individual. So I prefer to use the word reintegration because it puts the onus on us as a community. That's my thought about it. You all got, either one of you have any anything to say to that? Any thoughts?
I disagree 100%. Philadelphia, I believe they give $2 in a token.
Oh, shut up.
And oh yeah.
Wait a minute, Felicia. Did I get, because I know I forgot to tell you I wear hearing aids. Did you say $2 and a token?
I believe it's $2 in a token. I don't think it's not $75. And if anyone's listening and I am wrong, please, I admit if I am wrong. But from what I remember, it's definitely at least $2 and a token. I'm not sure what the bus fare is because I drive, but, yeah, that's what it is, and you get to where you need to go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so I definitely agree. That's what reentry is. Reentry is just saying, hey, you're released, bye-bye. And reintegrate, yes, it has more emphasis on, okay, now where do I fit in? How do I, quote, unquote, be normal, you know, into this community, into this society, be successful, and you know, be a part of that community? Where's my place? Where do I fit in? So, yeah, I agree 100%.
Wow. Doctor, do you know what it is in California?
I don't know the specific programs in California for reintegration, but I know that there are programs for reintegration. I know that I'm aware of a very good parolee program for mental health. That I know. I'm very aware
right.
of that. But I
right.
know that there are programs. I also am very aware that there were a couple of patients that had infectious diseases, which were really, that they were my patients. And so I can talk because I know what I did. We made certain that they were followed up in the community hospitals. We made certain that they had their whole treatment taken care of. That was taken, I mean, that much. On what I have done, I can remember, but I don't know. Is this a blanket statement? I cannot say that
right.
for certain. But I honestly believe that that is the problem, that these people don't have a proper reintegration program.
They
need to
right.
have someone to help them, society, to help them to, you know, to assimilate back into society. Otherwise,
absolutely.
They're going to come back into prison, unfortunately.
Absolutely. I think our producer lives in California, and she believes that people in California are given a bus ticket and at least $200. The cost of living is higher.
Wow.
I can understand that. Well, but, you know, it's probably taken up as quick as your $2. You know, in California, you can't go across the street fine with, you know, with $2 at all, right? But, you know,
yes.
The point is our prison systems do not provide them with what they need to be successful. And that means if we want people to be successful, it behooves us as community members to care, to really get involved, and to vote. I love what you said, Felicia. We have got to vote. We've got to vote not just for the president, but for
mm-hmm.
our local city council, our local state legislators, our local Congress, so on and so forth, because these people make laws, and we need to be
mm-hmm.
informed voters. Did you all know this? Okay, in every state in the United States, there is some type of law prohibiting or at least limiting the voting rights and privileges of people coming out of prison, with the exception of two states. In many states, you can vote if you are off paper, like in Georgia. If you're off paper, off parole, probation, no, not on any paper, you can vote. In Indiana, you can vote as soon as you walk out of prison, even if you're on paper. Do you know what it is in Philadelphia?
Oh, let me see.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Pennsylvania. This topic did come to me. Because I want to be correct. I want to be correct. Because I know there are a few people that ask me, you know, Felicia, what do you think about ex-inmates not being able to vote? But there have been different organizations that is fighting for them to vote.
Yeah.
So that this is a great area for me in that area because I'm not clear and concise on if they are actually able to, if there's something that they're still fighting for, like being a boxer. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, and I will definitely find out for sure.
Okay. And I want to talk about being a boxer, too. And I'm not sure what it is in California. Doctor, do you know if someone can vote in California?
No, I'm not sure about what it is in California, but this much I'm sure, that if a person is married to an inmate, I'm talking about a lady who's married to an inmate, she will get free medical care for herself and for the children, and they will be getting some kind of, you know, we call it as Medi-Cal. She will get that. That much I'm very certain about.
Okay. There are... Oh, you know what, Felicia? I looked up what it is in Pennsylvania. At least per the internet, if you live in Pennsylvania, you can vote once you are released from prison. If you are serving probation or on parole, you are entitled to vote. So, but you have to reestablish your voting right. And if you
exactly.
Felon voting in Pennsylvania, and this came out, and it tells you how to go about reestablishing. It's not automatic, so there is a process, I guess, that you have to follow. But
I'm
listen
sure.
up, ladies. In Maine and Vermont, people can vote while they are incarcerated, while they are in prison.
That's great.
Yes. But they are the only two states in the country where people can vote while they are incarcerated. And I'm going to leave that alone. That's a whole different kind of conversation there. Because then you have to look at who lives in Maine and Vermont.
For sure.
Okay.
For sure.
So,
absolutely.
Going on. Yeah, I feel you, Felicia. I feel you. I heard that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, listen, what do you think society's role is as it relates to incarcerated lives? Why should the general public care about incarcerated lives? Why should it matter?
You know what? It should matter because we complain enough. We complain about either a crime rate, drugs, and different things that's going on in a lot of our communities. So if we have that same energy and that same breath that we can complain, it's important to also support organizations that are similar and like the New Faith Inc. that wanted to help those that are released from prison. We can't complain about the problem but not aid to a solution. It don't work. You know what I'm saying? It don't work both ways. It's either you're going to just stand there and complain or you're going to help. And helping doesn't mean, now don't get me wrong, everyone is not called to work with ex-offenders. I totally get it, you know. Everyone's not going to, you know, volunteer. I mean, it'll be great, but volunteer at an organization to help those who are released from prison. But you have to find some, you have to find, a place where you're able to fit in, where you're saying, okay, well, you know what, if I can't volunteer, let me donate, you know, or let me reach out to an organization and give them the information that I have that can possibly help someone that is released from prison. It's everybody's issue. It's everybody's problem.
Oh, it's everybody's issue. Yes.
You know, it may not be your brother. It may not be your mother or your cousin or a family member that's incarcerated, but these people are released, and I say these people not to segregate them, but they're released back into these same communities, the communities
right.
that we live in, that our children go to school, that we work in. So, I mean,
yes.
it's everybody's problem.
Yes. I don't know if you know, in 2008, Pew Center for the State released a report and polled them. One out of every 100 persons in the United States is incarcerated. One out of every
wow.
100. So that means
wow.
that if we, general public, don't care about incarcerated lives, if we don't care about what happens to their children, if we don't care about the rights that are stripped from them, then we're really hurting ourselves as a country because of the significant number of people, the sheer number of people who are directly impacted either through incarceration or because the breadwinner is now incarcerated or because children have parents who are now incarcerated, whatever, right? It's a domino effect. And if we,
mm-hmm.
general public, doesn't care, doesn't feel that it's our problem, then the problem is not going to get better. It will indeed
Absolutely.
Get worse. And we can't wait for somebody else to fix it. We got to get involved. So then that leads me to my next question. What are some things that general Joe Blow public can do to get involved in helping to turn this tide around?
You know,
Doctor,
Matthew,
you want to go first, Doctor? Okay.
And I want to go first about something that can be done for these, I keep calling them patients because that's how I call them. For the people who are incarcerated, I think what can be done, which is really reasonable and can be done, is to give them a skill. You know, we have a lot of different programs in California to give them a skill, you know,
okay.
even to read the Braille or to do something so that they have a skill when they come out. So they have an advantage compared to somebody who doesn't have a skill. And I think that it's not that difficult to get this skill while they are incarcerated. When they get something, they have schools to go to or a vocational place to go to. Their mind is so involved, and I think that helps them to have a fruitful incarceration instead of just wasting their time there.
You are so right, Doctor. And there was a period of time, if you all can remember, when our prisons, we were in what's called the medical era, and we were thinking that we could treat or assist people who were incarcerated to get better by providing education, by providing vocational training, and providing those skills that you're talking about. We realized that there was some merit to teaching skills prior to release. Well, what happened was there was a guy, why did his name just leave me, Martinson. He was a social scientist who was charged with kind of evaluating post-release programs, and he wrote a paper, I want to say in the 1980s, it may have been a little bit later than that, that basically said nothing works. And that's when funding stopped for our educational programs inside of our prisons. Taxpayers said, we don't want to pay for those people to learn how we don't want them to get a degree. We don't want them to learn how to read and write. We want to punish them. And punishment became the word for the day instead of rehabilitation, right?
Exactly.
And when that happened, the money dried up in terms of funding the very programs that you're talking about, Doctor. So I think you're on point. We need to return back to realizing that we can definitely reduce recidivism rates if we begin to get in front of the problem, not only in terms of in front of the problem in terms of incarceration, but while they are in prison, across the board have programs that will help them to learn a skill and then encourage employers to hire them when they get out.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk about that
mm-hmm.
too. Felicia, what do you have to add?
No, I totally agree. I think we turned up the notch on punishment and turned the notch all the way off on rehabilitation. You know what I'm saying? Again, this all has a part to do with the community. Okay, you know, I get it. Okay, they're in prison. They have to do their time. Rehabilitate them while they're in there. So it's a smooth transition when they are released. So even
mm-hmm.
if they are released to a new phase, Inc., that we won't be starting from scratch, you know?
Right.
If someone don't have their GED and when they were incarcerated, help them obtain that in prison. Let them get their let them take up some college courses.
Absolutely.
Pick up a trade. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Their lives have to matter to us, you know, because it becomes then a win-win situation. As long as we have a us versus them mentality, we all suffer. It's not until
mm-hmm.
we really see that we all are part of one big village. And that
yeah.
it,
mm-hmm.
it takes all of us working together to begin to turn the tide around, so to speak. So I have a vision of what. But let me before I go to my vision, I want to go back to. Let me stay on track here for a moment before I go there. One of the things what I actually focused on. Doing my when I was getting doing my dissertation was transitional jobs for newly released people, and those are jobs that are subsidized either by through private corporations or government grants and scholarships to allow individuals who are coming out of prison to earn a decent wage for a set period of time while working on a job in the public sector. It doesn't have to be, but I'll talk about that in a moment. And they're learning a skill, they're working out in the public, and learning how to interact successfully with other people, usually for about 3 months. And then the idea is that the employer will then absorb them into their own payroll because they would have shown
mm-hmm.
themselves worthy. In Indianapolis,
mm-hmm.
I ran such a program for the city of Indianapolis, and we received federal dollars to pay them. So that was our transitional job. In New York, they have CEO, which is a transitional jobs program where individuals work in clusters doing different kinds of work, a job in different buildings, like they may clean up or they may the inside of a building, they may work in a park or what have you. But CEO, the organization, and I can't remember what that stands for, but they hired them to do these particular jobs. In Chicago, they had the SAFER Foundation that does some of the same type of things that you do on a bigger level, Felicia, to where they
mm-hmm.
also have a transitional jobs kind of a situation. I wholeheartedly believe in that concept because it forms a bridge and a kind of
yeah.
a getting myself together kind of thing between prison and between being living in the community all by yourself, you know. So it's that bridge between that. So I just wanted to let people know, our listening audience know about that concept. I would love to see transitional jobs in every city in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Agree. Agreed.
That, it ain't happening, but, you know, that's my vision, right? So I want to think about, I want to ask you, what is your vision as it relates to the lives of previously incarcerated people, people who are out in the streets now, who have done their time and now they're out? What is your vision for them, you know, as free people in our country? What's your vision for them?
Doctor, you want to go first, Doctor?
Okay. Actually, my vision is more for the people who are inside the prison. Because
I'm coming to that. I'm going to ask that, too. So So you want to hold off and answer when I ask that question, Doctor?
Okay. All
okay.
Right.
So let me go to you, Felicia. What's your vision as it relates to the lives of people who are out?
Let me see. Support, the continuous support for them. Doctor mentioned in earlier questions that she mentioned institutionalized, that there are some people that are institutionalized. So, and that is someone that has been in prison for so long that it's become a norm for them. And that prison that they're in is a support. And I feel like if we can apply the same thing when they're out, if we can make them, help them just be a normal citizen, to fit, a law-abiding citizen, to fit into society, giving them that same support, you know, the same energy that they use, you know, that they had to be institutionalized, if we can do the same thing outdoors, you know, and when they're released, when they're free, if we could apply that same type of pressure and support for them, that's how I see it. That's how I would see it. And that support could be very broad. It can be employment. It could be the mental health services. It can be education services. It could be parenting services. I mean, it's very broad, but just providing that support overall.
Absolutely. I would agree in that they need the support. I think I call it the insanity of reentry. For us to believe that people can be successful in their own reintegration efforts without any support is insane. And we keep expecting that. And the definition of insanity is to do the same thing, the same all the time, and expect a different result. We're the insane ones. Hello. Right? Okay. So, Doctor, you were going to tell us about your vision for people who are incarcerated. And I want you to answer, if you will, from two perspectives as it relates to whatever your vision is, and particularly how can prison reform help to make your vision a reality? What needs to be done with prison reform to make your vision a reality? First, tell us your vision, and then how can prison reform help make that vision come true?
Okay. I think the secret for me was I had a very open, curious, non-judgmental mind, and I could learn so much from the inmates. That was my attitude. They can be excellent teachers, and do you know when you give them that attitude, how beautifully they will draw? They knew that I come from India, and I would always say, you have to be the change that you want to happen.
All right.
And so one of the inmates did this beautiful painting of something depicting change, and he put it up, and he said, "Doc, would you like it in the clinic?" So what I'm trying to say is that I encourage the creativity of my patients. You know, they were able to write beautiful things. They were able to go and learn. Encourage them to get educated or do art or do whatever, or sometimes just sit and talk and get some wisdom from them. And I have gotten a lot of wisdom, and really, read the book and you'll see the story of wisdom that I have gotten from my inmate patients. So I really think for people who work there, I think you have to have a special kind of attitude. Your attitude should be open, it should be curious, and it should be non-judgmental.
Okay,
and I think what that attitude really brings about the positive change. And I would really like to see a lot more programs when you're talking about prison reform. I would like to see lots of programs for the inmates when they are incarcerated. So we have to have a goal where almost all of them should have a skill when they get out.
Right.
And skill can so vary. And that's what I would like to see. I would
like to how can the average citizen help to make that happen? What can we do, Doctor?
You can just write to your congressman. You can write to your senator. You could do rallies where you invite them and you talk to them about it so that they are aware of it. Most of them may not even know what's happening.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep.
I think it's something that we all can get involved in. Too often we sit around and we say it's their problem, let them do something, or we wait for the next prison reform messiah, and we really are it, right? I was talking to a young gentleman. He's I'm trying to say it without giving out who he is, but a young man. Mm-hmm. He's in the age of the millennials, that that age group that we classify as millennials. And I had invited him to come to the university where I teach right before the presidential election. And I've been telling my students to get involved, to vote, to write to their congresspeople, to become active in the political machinery of our country. Let your voice be heard, right? I've been preaching that and preaching that. And this young man got up in front of my students and everybody and said that he could not vote, because he would not vote because he could not vote for either candidate. And I was appalled. I'm like, oh, you know, no, don't tell my folks that you don't vote. No, you know, that is not acceptable, right? You cannot come into this university and tell people you don't vote, right? That's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. I happened to see him about a week ago, and I asked him, okay, now, with where we are in our country now, what would you say to yourself if you knew then what's going on now? What would your answer be different than what you gave almost a year ago? And he looked at me. He said, Dr. Bryan, he said, I was so wrong. He said, I made a mistake. I was wrong. People need to get involved and vote. Though, even if you feel you're voting for the lesser of two evils, the lesser of two evils is better than evil.
Yeah.
And I had to hug him. I'm like, you're a little bit late, but I'm glad you got it. You know, because there'd be another opportunity for you to vote and to get involved. And now you can let people know the mistake that you made and how you got to think of a problem, not on an individual basis, but how is it going to impact the masses? And I can, my little getting involved, my little letter to a congressman, my little protest, my little vote, all of that, it matters. And one of the things that I'm trying to do here, Beverly, I mean, I keep calling you Beverly. Felicia, I'd like to know if there's anything that exists in Philadelphia. One of the things we had in Indianapolis was a group of people who were previously incarcerated individuals who band together, who joined together to impact decisions and policies in Indianapolis. And if you think about it, somebody mentioned earlier about the Ban the Box movement. And, Doctor, I don't know if you knew this, but the whole Ban the Box movement began with a group of previously incarcerated people who would call all of us or none of us in California. I was speaking at a conference way back when and met them, and they were banding together then to start the momentum for banning the box. And now it's all over the country, right? Cities across the country are adopting Ban the Box. But it started with a small group of previously incarcerated people in California. Did you know that, Doctor?
I didn't know it, but it doesn't surprise me because I just finished telling you that they can be so smart, so intelligent, they just need the right venue to do it.
You're absolutely right. So, Felicia, do they have anything like that? Any group, support group comprised of previously incarcerated people in Philadelphia?
I'm sure there is. It just left my mind. But I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are. I wish it could just roll off my tongue. But I'm sure there are. Philadelphia is such a great city.
You really are.
Such a great city, and I'm just honored to even have this organization here because it's needed here. But definitely such a great city. But no, I cannot think off the top of my head a group of ex-inmates that have grouped together to make a bigger impact. But again, I am 100% they are.
Okay. And can you imagine the power in numbers?
Absolutely.
If everyone in every city who has a record, a criminal history, band together, how much power they would have to turn this whole country around, really.
For sure.
There's
for sure.
power in numbers. Doctor, I want to go
yes,
back
there
to
are.
What you said about how people who are behind bars are really intelligent. They're, I think the notion is that they're dumb, they're listless, they ain't about nothing, don't have anything going on. But I have met some extremely intelligent people who were incarcerated. I mean, brilliant minds. I often tell my class about my favorite criminal, so to speak. And he was a young man in his 20s who, back in the 80s, before everyone had a computer, figured out how to create counterfeit European pounds on the computer and counterfeit U.S. dollars. Now, in the United States, in Florida, he made counterfeit European pounds. And over in Europe, he made counterfeit U.S. dollars. Because at the time, it was not against the law to make counterfeit foreign currency. It is now because of him. But it wasn't then. Right? Brilliant. Well, the only thing that got him caught was greed. But can you imagine? Brilliant.
Wow.
I have had experience of meeting some brilliant attorneys in prison. I've met some brilliant artists. I've met some brilliant poets. Oh, that's what I said. To have a mind that I was willing to listen, and they sensed it that she's willing to listen.
Yes, yes.
And I think it was good for both of us. So I learned a lot there.
Yes, yes, yes. So I don't know if we have any callers at this point, but I think if we can have one final commercial, then after that commercial break, what we'll do is have final words from each of our guests.
Okay.
Have you been frozen in fear, stuck on stupid, lost in love, tormented with troubling relationships, felt disconnected, discombobulated, and dismissed? Has parenting ever felt more like a burden than a blessing? Have you questioned your own sanity, doubted your own self-worth, wish you were someone else somewhere else? Do you ever feel you're not good enough, not pretty enough? Not smart enough, not talented enough, unworthy, unlovable, undeserving, then you know what it feels like to be out of your groove. The Groove Doctor has just the right prescription. Get your copy of Dr. Maxine Vine's book, I Want My Groove Back God's Way. Begin your journey today living in real groove. Dr. Maxine Brown uses her own experiences and spiritual insights to guide the reader to a place of real groove by helping readers attain a holistic state of groove based on Bible principles. Go to www.mygrooveback.com to order your copy today. $10 plus shipping costs. You will be glad you did.
Okay, ladies, I just want to thank each of you again for being a part of Incarcerated Lives Matter 2, produced by Beverly Black, the creator of Tribe Family Channel, Gumbo for the Soul, and Diane Sears, the U.S. Coordinator for International Men's Day, author and editor, host of In Search for Fatherhood. I do want to let people know that our next show is going to be on February the 24th, and our guest will be a man who is currently serving life. His name is Carl Cooper. And we're going to be able to talk with him. Our other guest is going to be civil rights activist. And she's also a Tougaloo 9 member, Miss Geraldine Hollis. And we will be talking to Dr. Amina Ali, the architect of the national model to resolve child support debt for incarcerated fathers. So you don't want to miss that. February the 24th will be the next show of Incarcerated Lives Matter 2. Now, before we end this dynamic, exciting, informative edition of Incarcerated Lives Matter 2, I want to give each of our guests an opportunity to have a final word. So we'll start with you, Miss Felicia Dennis. What do you have to say to our listening audience?
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, listening in. Today was such a great discussion, a lot of fresh and new information. Thank you so much. To get in contact or to get involved, to refer someone, please just go to thenewfaithinc.com. the newfaceinc.com, and that our site will connect you to our social media, our email, and our telephone number. Again, thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Felicia Dennis, all the way from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, going across country, Dr. Gatunda. Gatunde.
Hi. You know, there's a saying that says, if it excites you and scares you at the same time, it probably means that you should accept the challenge. This was the emotion I felt when I got a job in Folsom Prison. I accepted the challenge, and what a wonderful journey I had. So when I retired, I was truly sad to leave my patients and to leave the place. And I will quote Winnie the Pooh, who says, how lucky I was to have something that makes saying goodbye so hard. Mm. And I would like, finally, to tell all your listening audiences to please read my book, 8,596 Miles, the exact, literally, distance from my home in Madras to Folsom Prison in Northern California. It is my journey, it is my leap of faith, and I honestly believe you will all enjoy reading the book. Thank you for having me here, and I do appreciate this very, very much.
Awesome, awesome. It has been a pleasure conversing with the two of you. I'm sure our audience is coming away being enlightened, informed, inspired, all of that good stuff. It's been a pleasure. I am your host, Dr. Maxine Bryant. Please tune in to the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show this coming Monday on February the 29th. We're going to be talking about When Love Hurts. It's our pre-Valentine's Day special. You got to tune in to hear more about it. Take care. Have a wonderfully blessed weekend. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Just like a bird, I just want to fly free. And I own a piece of land somewhere off in a country. Oh, hey, listen. Temperatures like 100 degrees, like I got chains for me. Black male in the family of three, been proud of my destiny. Reckon I'll fly away, cause it's too much for the man. Shouldn't have gone down this way. What happened to my master plan? Cause I can't figure out, I could have been a love child. Shouldn't have gone down this way. Tell me, how did I get lost? Oh, yeah. Talk to me. Oh, how did I get lost? Tell me, yeah. Oh, yeah. Close to a peace of mind. Everything was about to be fine.